Okay, welcome everybody to CSIS. I'm Jeff Mankoff with the Russia and Eurasia program here. I want to commend you on showing up on the Friday before Memorial Day weekend for what I hope will be a very informative talk with Anna Kareeva, who's an associate professor in the Department of Asian and African Studies at Moscow State University, MGIMO, and is going to be talking to us today about the development of Sino-Russian relations. Of course, as you all know, the U.S. National Security Strategy has defined China and Russia as strategic rivals to the United States. As relations with both of those countries have gotten worse over the last couple of years, we've seen serious movement closer between the two of them, increasing cooperation in a number of areas. And a lot of people in this town have started asking, what does that mean? What is the long-term significance of that rapprochement? Are Russia and China moving towards an alliance? What does their cooperation mean for global order and for the United States? And we're very lucky to have Anna Kareeva here to provide a Russian perspective on all of those questions. As I said, she's a professor at Moscow State University. She works with the Russian International Affairs Council. She's an expert on East Asia and Russian policy towards East Asia. She works on Japan, Korea, China, a lot of other things. She is the co-author of a new report out with the Russian International Affairs Council on Russo-Japanese relations, and apparently was just in New York for a track two focused on the North Korean problem. So she has very wide-ranging expertise, and I think we don't have enough Russian voices here in Washington talking about this critically important relationship. And we're very lucky today to have somebody who's one of Russia's best experts on that topic. So thank you all for joining us, and Anna, please.
Thank you, Jeff, for your introduction. Nice to meet you. Good morning. Thank you for making it here. I'll try to make a kind of perspective of how generally Russia-China relations are perceived in Russia and how they have been developing lately. Well, I'll also try to look in a more or less comprehensive way, touching upon political, security, and also economic aspects, bilateral and regional dynamics, and what it actually means for regional cooperation and what implications it has. So basically, Russia-China relations have actually gone a very long way to the current stage, and there has been a number of reasons for that. And the key rationale that has been driving Russia and China closer since 1990s has actually been striving for a multipolar or a polycentric world order. This has been the underpin of the alignment between the two countries. So the idea is that there should be several centers of power, and that they should be equal, that they should negotiate how the world order should look like. And of course, it was kind of strengthened by the opposition of both countries to U.S. Unilateral actions and what was seen as U.S. desire to establish its dominance in unipolar order. Also, the two countries share norms such as respect for mutual sovereignty, territorial integrity, and non-interference into domestic politics. And actually, they are trying to promote these norms in a number of regional institutions and international institutions, such as BRICS, for example. Another thing is that the reform of global governance is needed, and it should reflect better the role of not only Western powers, but also other powers as well, including Russia and China. A very key thing was that the two countries actually have gone a long way to demilitarizing border, and whatever the policy is, we have to accept that China is one of Russia's key neighbors with a very long border, and that stability on the border and between the two is crucial for Russia's security. This has been also the understanding for all this time. And basically, the key idea is that Russia and China do not support policies that are aimed at each other, such as balancing policy of one country against each other, which basically means that they cannot be fully geopolitically encircled, and it has been one of the key things for the security of the two. And Also, Russia-China relations have arguably emerged as one of the key factors in international relations, I mean, of a system-level factor, not just the bilateral relations. Russia and China do share an approach to a number, well, rather large number of security problems. However, I should say that what we have seen and what we still do see is rather an alignment than alliance. And one of the arguments that we can actually provide is that the two countries have kind of strategic neutrality position to the issues which do not fall within the category of their core national interests, such as Ukraine and Crimea for China, and such as South China Sea for Russia, and also, well, East China Sea, of course, as well, Asian territorial disputes for Russia. Of course, China has been very important in terms of the development of the Far East. That is considered to be one of the key things, of the key goals that Russia really wants to achieve in terms of domestic politics, economic development, and also foreign policy as well. This is the least densely populated part of Russia, and only about 6 million people live there, and this is the part that actually makes Russia geographically belong, together with Siberia, to East Asia and to Northern Pacific. So China, of course, has been a kind of a centerpiece of the key elements relations with China, of Russia's pivot to Asia, Russia's own desire to be more engaged with Asia, to improve its standing in the region, and to become a part of regional integration and economic cooperation, also in many ways to develop the Far East. We should also, of course, take a note that sanctions by the United States and the rift with the United States and Europe with the West resulted in Russia becoming much more active in developing relations with China and, trying to accelerate its turn to the East or its pivot to Asia thing. And Russia-China relations have been the key dimension of this. I mean, the developments that we have seen, they mostly make us look at Russia-China relations. China was seen as the major safeguard against the damage that was dealt by the Western sanctions, as the key partner that did not criticize Russia, and as the key partner who was also opposite, who expressed his opposition to the sanctions. And since that time, we have seen that relations comprehensively, political, security, economic relations, have actually entered a new stage. Since 2014, it is already an indisputable fact. Relations become and still are mostly focused on political and security dimension. Here we have the personal ties between the two leaders, and President Putin was the leader who met Xi Jinping much more times than any other leader in the world. We have also mutual support of both elites, and just again a good personal rapport between the leaders. We have a lot of institutionalized cooperation on the intergovernmental level between different agencies, and it has become a practice that we have annual high visits, and we have several meetings a year at different organizations, meaning that Russia and China have been able to coordinate their policy in a way that is almost unprecedented for their relationship in general, for their foreign policy in general, so that they have frequently this ability to exchange opinions and coordinate their responses. Actually, Russia and China, as major powers, as great powers, of course, do have points of convergence and, of course, points of divergence, and national interests somewhere correspond to each other, and somewhere they do not, somewhere they overlap. This is quite natural, and this is seen natural in both capitals. However, that said, Russia and China have really worked very hard to minimize these differences, to minimize these divergences, and quite a history of several centuries of relationship, not just like the last 70 or 80 years, have told the countries that they should avoid confrontation, that this would be much more desirable for their security, again, taking into consideration a huge border. So we have had a number of political declarations on the new stage of comprehensive partnership and on strengthening global strategic stability. One thing that we could point here attention to is the new vision of strategic stability that was expressed in the joint declaration of 2016, where Russia and China endorsed the common vision that there should be no threat of force or no use of force, and both said that they were against deployment of ballistic missile defense all over the world, and especially with special reference to Asia, and under what is understood as false pretenses, meaning that that it was a kind of unnecessary thing. Well, also, there is a lot of regional cooperation going on, and these are different organizations, of course, such as Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And we have seen recently a lot of discussions and a lot of cooperation going on here as well. One thing that probably should be just important to keep in mind is that during these years, security cooperation has also reached a new dimension, which puts, according to Russian military experts, puts the two countries technically on the verge of alliance, actually, on the verge of possible joint responses according to the level of their joint mutual exercises, according to the level of confidence building measures. Basically, Russia and China have been running a number of exercises. These are ground exercises, peace mission within the under the auspices of Shanghai Cooperation Organization since 2005, which are ground and air exercises. Also, from 2012, Russia and China have been running maritime exercises. And in the last years, we have seen the geography of these exercises. It has really increased a lot, it is not only just the Sea of Japan and the Pacific. The vicinity of both countries, it has also been the Mediterranean Sea. It has been the Baltic Sea and the Black Sea. So it's kind of trying also to have a more global outreach, and especially it's important for China, because with these naval exercises with Russia, China is able to go into the waters where its navy was not really that present before that. So also there was one exercise in the South China Sea, which actually was not near the disputed waters at all, but was just near the coast of Guangdong province. It didn't have anything to do with the territorial dispute per se. There are also new kind of exercises which took place for the first time in 2016 and then were repeated in 17. These are joint military exercises in ballistic missile defense, in computer simulating exercises in ballistic missile defense. The third time is planned for this year, and these exercises mostly focus on joint planning on air defense, ballistic missile defense, including possible joint interactions if there is some provocation or accident which would include ballistic missiles or cruise missiles fired at the countries. This was basically seen a reaction to the all the tensions, all the crisis on the Korean Peninsula. So It is. It should probably be assessed in this way. Other spheres that Russia and China here interact is also anti-submarine warfare, joint missile and artillery strikes, and these kind of operations on the water as well. Also, 2016, the two countries agreed to set up a mechanism to coordinate information security, and there have been, initiative to discuss these spheres as well. As for arms sales, there used to be rather a huge downturn in arms sales since early or mid 2000s, and we have recently seen revitalizing military cooperation when Russia agreed to supply 24 Sukhoi Su 35 generation 4++ multi-role fighters and S-400 Triumph system ballistic missile defense system. And here, probably we should take a note that the negotiations actually had been underway for many years before that, and that Russia usually, for these years, have chosen to supply China with one but the latest technology, one but the latest aircraft, and it was already quite clear that S-500 was also underway. So here probably the crisis with the West kind of pushed Russia to reach these deals earlier as possible. However, as I said, that they were actually in negotiations for many years before that, and one of the explanations that we have was that Russia probably waited for some new new generation to emerge as well. There has been a practice of strategic consultations at the levels of deputy chiefs of general staff. There is annual strategic stability dialogue on the level of Security Council of Russia, the Secretary of Security Council, and Secretary of Central Foreign Affairs Commission in China. So quite a high level established security dialogue here as well. And the latest thing has been Vostok 2018, with China participating in this exercises, which are considered kind of strategic level rather than local level exercises. And basically, all of these are aimed at trust building, increasing interoperability between different kinds of troops, logistics, and better understanding of the strengths and weaknesses of each other. Again, there not all the areas have been tapped here in this defense cooperation, but it basically means that Russia and China technically and operationally were well prepared to have some joint actions if a political decision is made to do so, which has not been the case yet at all. So this is just what I want to point out, that again, we have seen just new kind of step up of security cooperation since then, entering new domains and entering new geographic scope. So as far as economic relations are concerned, the picture is of course somewhat different. And as I said before, the relations have been centered basically on good rapport between the leaders, political and security cooperation. As for economic relations, Russia-China economic relations have always been characterized by quite an unbalanced structure, being mostly focused on natural resources that Russia sells to China in exchange for manufactured goods, some clothes and textiles, so just basically manufactured goods. What we have seen since then is that Russia-China trade actually experienced a fall in 2015. It was again, as a result of the Ukrainian crisis and oil prices rising down, which had an effect on all Russians' foreign trade, not just simply with China. But since then, we have actually seen a very rapid restoration and even increase of Russia-China trade. And last year, it actually exceeded $100 billion, and the figure was $108 billion, which was a 24% growth if we compare it to the previous year. So what we have seen basically here, there are a number of really large-scale projects. Probably one of the most spoken about, of course, is Power of Siberia pipeline, which the deal which was reached in 2014, and it is to come into operation December this year, actually. So it has already almost been built, and it is estimated to supply 38 billion cubic meters of gas every year, and the estimated cost is $400 billion, which is quite immense. Of course, this is mostly China's financing that was required for this deal. The negotiations again were underway for more than a decade before that, and the negotiations weren't going easy. We can suggest that Russia decided that it's time to have this deal. Also, we have had China's investment into other energy projects. So energy, has been one of the key areas of China's investment. For example, here we have China's investment into Yamal LNG, liquefied natural gas project in the Arctic, which has already been operating and which has already for the last couple of years been supplying gas to China, liquefied natural gas through the Arctic route, through the northern route. Another was the first ever coming of Chinese companies to as strategic investors into Russian oil and gas companies, which actually had no precedent before due to informal guarantees, which were quite easened. There was the easement of these guarantees. And China, it was Sinopec, which acquired a 10% share in Sibur petrochemical company. This is to illustrate some other power plants, and there are also a number of projects that Russia has been building in China, such as Tianyuan nuclear plant and new lines for this plant, also Tianjin oil processing plant. So of course, mostly this is China's investment into Russia, but there have been some projects going on for long years also, vice versa, from Russia in China. A new fact is that Russia emerged as the top oil supplier to China in 2016 and 2017, even surpassing Saudi Arabia. This was due to ESPO, East Pacific Ocean pipeline, and mostly to the fact of that has been in operation already for a long time. However, last year Russia was not the first country. It was either second or third, meaning that Russia's share is large, but it's not like dominant, it's not prevalent in China's oil market. And the two countries also last year agreed to cooperate in nuclear energy, in peaceful nuclear energy. We have also seen, which is really new, increasing cooperation in other different economic spheres of relationship on the scale that, again, had no precedent before. These are basically agriculture, with China opening up its market for Russian crops, and now there are negotiations underway to open the market for Russian meat as well. The share of Russia's export, agricultural export to China in Russia's export to China is about 5%. So it has actually risen over the last years, with Russian agricultural products becoming more competitive in the market. However, of course, it does has a number of obstacles here. In IT sphere and telecommunications, this is mostly Russia buying Chinese equipment, this kind of cooperation going on. equipment, IT solutions from Huawei, ZTE. And last year there was a huge deal with Alibaba, which has gained real prominence in Russia since it entered the market in 2015. Alibaba, Russian Megaphone and Mail.ru Group, to have a joint venture specifically in Eurasia in order to become a leader in e-commerce. And Russian companies have share about 52%, so more than half of the share. Another is retailing and finance. One of the things that has always characterized why we don't have really that much of investment cooperation has been lack of financing. So in the last several years, we have seen some new investment funds established, about four or five of them in different spheres. And the Russia-China Investment Fund also gained additional capital because its all capital had been actually used into joint projects. So we have been having some new financial funds here in general, in IT, agriculture, and manufacturing. The two key manufacturing projects that also had no precedent that Russia and China are working now on are joint development of wide-body long-range aircraft, a civilian one, and a heavy transport helicopter, a civilian helicopter that could jointly be a joint project and could have a share in the world market and in the Chinese market as well. Also, tourism has been on the rise. Actually, China emerged recently as number one country supplying tourists to Russia, and more than 1.5 billion a year. And now you can increasingly see big cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg, also tourist attractions written not only in Russian and English, but Chinese as well. This is quite a new development here. However, as far as tourism is concerned, it is still mostly a close linked with on Chinese companies, meaning that Chinese companies mostly supply all the chain of Chinese tourists coming into Russia. Typical of China here. There is an issue, how many investment do we have in Russia? I mean, how many Chinese investment? Officially, if we look at Chinese figures, this is about $10 billion. However, part of Chinese investment actually come through offshores. And thus, the whole figure is larger. There is different assessment, how much larger is the figure. bless you. And probably it is, according to different estimates, it could be $20 or $30 billion. I mean, this is stock, if we look at FDI stock. Official figure that Chinese provide is about $10 billion all in all. And key sectors are energy, timber, agriculture, construction, trade, textiles, and services. We actually have not reached the key goal, key Russia's goal here in economic relations with China, the establishment of new quality of economic relations, new quality of economic interaction. There is still much work to be done on both sides, especially on the Russian side with our investment climate, in order to do it. So we have been having, but what I try to show that we have been having much more economic cooperation in a number of spheres, not only energy, that had no precedent before. Another very important issue is the Belt and Road Initiative, of course, for Russia. There has been a discussion and is still going on how to assess the Belt and Road Initiative. There are different visions in Russia. Is it an opportunity or is it a challenge? What Russia should do with it? Should it counter, embrace, or do some other thing? And here, if we look at Russia's response, we should probably take into consideration that Russia is interested in economic development, economic integration in Eurasia, and China now does provide a huge, huge financial stimulus and huge potential to have these plans actually become a reality. there was also understanding that if Moscow does not cooperate or reject the initiative, it will simply bypass Russia because of different paths. And so Russia's answers to the dilemma has been to try to shape it, meaning to take to support just the principles of linking Russia's own economic project, Russia's own economic integration, Eurasian Economic Union, with China's Belt and Road Initiative, and to try together to find how we could cooperate, how we could foster economic development in order for the Eurasian Economic Union to modernize, to become more competitive, and also to join the fourth industrial technological revolution, just to modernize comprehensively. And the key idea here has been that we need to build a cooperative space in Eurasia, that we should not compete with each other. Of course, rationally speaking, there are always and there have been elements of both competition and cooperation between Russia and China and Eurasia, but we should try at least to seek the common ways to do this. However, in practice, of course, it is a tricky thing. And one of the difficulties here is that it is difficult to assess what exactly the linking of Eurasian Economic Union with the Belt and Road Initiative means. It probably should be multilateral projects, but China mostly has been dealing bilaterally with Russia and with Central Asian states and other Eurasian Economic Union states. Another thing is that it is difficult to find the projects that will be economically viable and interesting for all states involved. Of course, everyone needs infrastructure, but the thing is that also China wants to use its labor, its technologies, its machinery, and all the components, all the materials for this construction, which probably Russia is not that happy with. To negotiate equitable terms has been difficult. So in practice, and this is how it has been developing. We have again had a number of bilateral projects, but multilateral projects are still under formulation and under discussing, mostly in infrastructure. There has been agreement reached in 2018 on economic and trade cooperation agreement between the Eurasian Economic Union and China, and it is to come into effect this year, actually. It is a non-preferential agreement because Russia and other countries of Eurasian Economic Union are not prepared for a free trade agreement. However, it has other elements such as trade facilitation, investment liberalization, customs regulation, electronic commerce, and even intellectual property rights. So this is how it has been basically developing. And there is also has been a feasibility study conducted on the Eurasian Economic Partnership, again, non-preferential agreement. When Putin spoke at the Belt and Road Forum April this year, he also said that we all have the common goals of economic development and economic growth, and that again stated Russia's own initiative of great economic partnership. The greater economic partnership could probably be seen as a kind of an answer to this Belt and Road challenge, what to do with this. Greater Eurasian partnership is a very vague concept, which Russian president says integration or of integrations, meaning that there should be a kind of a multi-level integration at different stages with different partners, and Russia should be one of the centers of this Eurasian integration. Actually, a lot of countries and even organizations were proposed as partners here. For Eurasian Economic Union, Shanghai Cooperation Organizations and its members, ASEAN, all post-Soviet states, Iran, European Union, and others, so that there should be some kind of different level of cooperation with different Eurasian partners. And recently, one of the examples, the Eurasian Economic Union has signed a free trade agreement with Vietnam, 2016, Russia's first free trade agreement and the first free trade agreement negotiated here. And other negotiations underway are with Singapore, Thailand, Cambodia, Indonesia, Iran, Egypt, Serbia, Israel, so actually a number of countries. With these considerations, there has been recently a concern in Russia and its foreign policy, in the foreign ministry and foreign policy community about the Indo-Pacific and what actually Indo-Pacific means for Russia and what should be the response to Indo-Pacific. There has been a speech by Lavrov in Vietnam, in Hanoi, just a couple of days before the Trump-Kim Jong-un summit, actually. And the reaction that was formulated by the foreign minister was quite pessimistic and quite not welcoming the Indo-Pacific, because Russia feels that it is at the current stage too concentrated on balancing China, which Russia would not welcome. And another thing is that it is kind of fostering competitive strategic space rather than cooperative space. When there is an issue with the rule-based order, the question that Russia usually seems to ask, whose rules and who is going to present these rules? And another thing is that it is undermining ASEAN-centric institutions, which for Russia is quite a matter of concern, because Russia is the least powerful major power in Asia, and for Russia it is important that there should be a common process based on ASEAN centrality, with Russia as one of the powers here. And if this the whole idea undermines ASEAN centrality, that probably Russia has no place here at all, although Russia geographically belongs to the Northern Pacific and just also is a Pacific country as well as a European country here. There is a concern, but however, there is also a debate, in Russia, how to assess the Indo-Pacific and does it create any opportunities for Russia as well. There are people who say that it is kind of an anti-Eurasian initiative as well, and people who say that Russia can also provide its own vision of what could be in the Pacific. And there are a lot of people also in the foreign ministry who would like to support less competitive visions of this region, such as Indonesian initiative and Indonesian vision, for example. So this is currently an issue under debate. Having said that, I should probably say that there also have been quite a number of challenges in Russia-China relations. And to be frank, it is again quite normal for major powers that they also do have problems and imbalances in their relations. And here the core thing is that mostly China has been benefiting for a long time, probably, from the strategic ambiguity that we had in the Russia-China-US triangle. And American actions pushed Russia closer to China, whether it was the intention or not. And of course, it does have strategic implications for Russia's foreign policy and for the balance of power in Asia and the world, too. If we look at this more and more, to increasing interdependence between the states in politics and security, we should see that in part it has been this acceleration, this more enhanced interdependence in politics and security has been, of course, the result of Russia's crisis with the West and with the US specifically. As far as economic relations are concerned, we can see that this interdependence has been becoming more asymmetric. The problem of unbalanced trade structure has not been really addressed. China has no real wish to address that. I mean, this is mostly Russia who should be interested in modernizing its economy and also changing the structure. Another thing is that China's share in Russia's trade has risen, while Russia's share in China's trade has not risen that much. China is now number one partner in Russia's trade, or number two if we take European Union collectively. And China's share is about 15% in Russia's trade. This is not that much as some other Asian countries have, but this is still quite a huge figure. And Russia is number 12 with 2% share in China's foreign trade. So this is a kind of imbalanced and then balanced trade structure has also always been here. Still, how to connect the Eurasian Economic Union and the Belt and Road Initiative, how to make this great Eurasian partnership a reality, it's still very debatable, and it really remains unclear how in practice it is going to develop. There is no roadmap here, no real understanding how projects would look like, and partly this is because Russia is economically, structurally very different from other partners on the China's Belt and Road Initiative, and it simply cannot use the same model with Russia. Here we also do have, of course, a part of competition as well as cooperation going on in Eurasia and Central Asia. There has also been a challenge for Russia how to make its pivot to Asia more balanced, how to retain the balance between relations with China and between the relations with all other states. The recent developments show us that there has been some progress with other countries, but it's not the same level of progress as Russia has had with China here. So this is quite a challenge for Russia. There's also an issue of different potentials, of different economic potentials. There are no many Chinese in Russia, actually. So this kind of yellow threat or yellow peril, it has really diminished since 1990s. You can't see people in the Far East talking about China threat. People in the Far East mostly view China as the real opportunity and see developing relations, economic relations with China as the opportunity to have better lives. Trust is something and a kind of mistrust that stems from different interpretations of history, and also difference in demographic and economic potential is somewhat natural for different potentials between Russia and China. Where do Russia's interests converge and diverge with those of China in Asia, and what are the implications? The key things that Russia and China interests converge here is that the two countries are not interested in U.S. supremacy and U.S. primacy in Asia, and critical of U.S. building up its alliances, critical of ballistic missile defense. Also, Russia and China are very closely aligned on the Korean Peninsula, just simply because the positions, are more or less similar. There is interest in maintaining stability in political dialogue in having, some negotiations process with Northern Korea rather than getting back to military tensions and military confrontation. Russia and China have also been arguing that there should be partial alleviating of sanctions or exemptions being made to North Korea in order to have this positive dynamic somehow rewarded. There was a roadmap produced by Russia and China in July 2017. And basically, it says that there should be dual freeze, freezing the nuclear missile tests and downgrading of U.S. South Korea exercises aimed at simulating invading North Korea, which is the case now, which we can actually see. The second stage is bilateral negotiations, which we can also see. And the third stage should be that what has been Russia mostly promoting, some multilateral format to discuss security guarantees and peace and how we could attain denuclearization in East Asia. However, there are a number of issues where Russia's and China's positions diverge. The one thing is that Russia is no interested in promoting China's dominance in Asia or China's supremacy, China's privacy. Well, what a community of common destiny means and what it means for Russia, for Eurasia, is also an issue. So if China takes a leading role, what should be the role for Russia here? Is there a role, any but not subordinate role for Russia? This is the issue that has also been discussed. Also, Russia has a number of partnerships and relations with other countries that it won't like to sacrifice, such as Russia-India relations, Russia-Vietnam relations, partnerships that have been strong, both strategic partnerships. Russia takes neutral position on the East China Sea, on South China Sea, and won't like to choose sides. Not sacrifice other interests in Asia due to its partnership with China. Here there are a number of issues where the interests of the two countries do diverge. Is there any room for Russia-US cooperation in Asia? I mean, looking at these implications. From what you can judge by Russia's Asian policy, including latest meeting between Putin and Kim Jong-un, is that Russia is trying to keep the balance between in its Asian policy between China and other parties. However, we can also witness closer political and security cooperation motivated by deteriorated relations between Russia and US, and now also US and China. Here again, this cooperation, this facilitation of cooperation has been really, to a large extent, driven by this negative dynamics and has a lot of strategic implications for Russia, for the US, and for Asia in general. It is very important, in my opinion, to avoid the risk of forming two opposite blocs, such as the Indo-Pacific thing and the Eurasian thing. Where Russia would be more stimulated to join China rather than maintain its current policy. Looking at Russia and US relations now, this is of course only rosy dreams probably. But our task as experts is also to lay some work for the future and to explore where Russia and US could have some points of cooperation. And basically, Russia and US have much less divergence in Asia than in other regions, like Europe or the Middle East. So, as Russia has no interest in China dominating Asia and wants to be a part of a polycentric regional and world order, there can be probably a basis for some cooperation if the current relations are normalized, whenever it happens, and if the problems on Asia worked only in the Asian context here. For now, it should be probably impossible. However, I won't suppose that it is impossible at all. There should be some major change in order for it to occur, probably, especially in bilateral relations. There are a number of issues that do need cooperation regionally, and that probably could somewhat contribute to to the strategies of different states, and these are both hard security and soft security and non-traditional threats issues, and also freedom of navigation, which Russia supports here in the Pacific, and of course it's again not really possible in the current conditions. But one of the things that we do share in common is the desire to avert the war in the Korean Peninsula, I guess, the common interest that there should be no military confrontation on the Korean Peninsula, that North Korea does not develop even more its nuclear and missile potential, which will have really negative consequences for all states involved, including Russia. So probably here one of the things that Russia would like to contribute and that could be somewhat appreciated is the multilateral process on the Korean Peninsula. I'll stop here.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to open it up to questions. Let me just sort of start where you ended, though, before we do that, which is I think you hit on what is kind of a central paradox, which is that I agree with you that U.S. and Russian interests in Asia and the Pacific are at odds to a much lesser degree than they are in other parts of the world. At the same time, because Asia and the Pacific is a lower priority in the overall U.S.-Russian relationship, we're not going to fix U.S.-Russian relations in the Asia-Pacific. We have to fix the relations in other ways and in other places, and greater cooperation in the Asia-Pacific could be one consequence of that. Let me just toss out one question and then we'll open it up to the audience, which is, you didn't talk a lot about Central Asia. Around here, when people talk about potential areas of cooperation between Russia and China, but also potential friction points, Central Asia comes up a lot. It's obviously the focal point of the Belt and Road Initiative. It's part of Russia's Eurasian Economic Union strategy and Greater Eurasia Partnership. But at the same time, the influx of Chinese investment and also Chinese security and political cooperation has come to some degree at the expense of Russian influence. Mm-hmm. So what is your vision of the role that Central Asia plays and is going to play in the future in the Sino-Russian relationship?
Thanks for the question. Yeah, I tried to more or less have a broad number of issues, but this is the one that I should probably delve into more. We do have here some interests that do converge and some interests that do diverge. As for convergence, both countries are interested in stability in Eurasia, and so that civil regimes remain in power. I guess this is quite important. And so again, attempts to build this cooperative order rather than competitive and antagonizing each other straight away. However, again, it's not tricky, and you're 100% right that there has been also a lot of strategic competition going on in Central Asia and Eurasia, of course, Russia does understand that it doesn't have the financial resources to provide this kind of alternatives that China now can with the Belt and Road Initiative. Russia has other strong points in Central Asia, including its security role here that probably are still appreciated by the Central Asian states. But there is not much that Russia could really can do now in terms of scale of economic cooperation. That's why, right, economically, China's position have been growing also partly, at the expense of Russia. Here we can see that Russia, of course, wouldn't like China to play a dominant role in Central Asia, for sure. Russia wouldn't like China, especially through economic means, to do the projects that would put these countries into too much dependence over China economically, again, at the expense of Russia. There is an issue that this quite a concept of division of labor that, for example, China can provide economics and Russia can provide political and security. This concept, is considered by many a kind of flawed concept from the very beginning, because it is unlikely that China would like to provide only economic role. So in one or two years, but sooner or later, China would also like to provide a huge security and political benefits goods in Central Asia. We can already see it happening in other Belt and Road countries like Pakistan, for example. So here, this is quite an issue, how to make these interests meet. However, I think there is general understanding in Russia that steel cooperation is the best, at least trying to find how we can cooperate and how it can contribute everyone, should be on the agenda, at least on the political, top political and political level. Again, it's not going to be easy. It is a very difficult task. And I think that the Russian government understands it very well, that it's not going to be easy. But again, it is still better than making some balancing acts or spoiling their relationship, where actually a lot of countries, including Central Asians, want better infrastructure, want major powers to provide more alternatives and to cooperate, but not like make them choose sides or do anything like this.
Okay, great. Let's open it up to questions. I think most of you know the ground rules, but I will just restate them. Please wait to be recognized. There'll be a microphone coming around, so please use the microphone. Identify yourself, be brief, and ask a question. So the first hand I saw was in the back there.
Hi, Richard Weitz, Hudson Institute. Thank you very much for your comprehensive assessment of the relationship.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Sure. Richard Weitz, Hudson Institute. Thank you very much for your comprehensive presentation. I just had a broad question about the triangle relationship. There are, of course, people in the U.S. who are concerned about the Russia-China relationship and prickling ahead about what that could imply for the future world order and so on. But people here are divided over the kind of strategy to pursue. So some people say, well, we should try and work with both countries, pull them together to build a cooperative new world order. Others say, no, we should confront them both. They're both threats to the United States. Mm-hmm. And then there are refinements. The third is either working with one to pull it away from the other. I don't know if you've thought about, based on your knowledge, general knowledge of international relations, what those strategies might look like in practice and how effective they might be. Thank you.
So how should the U.S. respond?
How should the U.S. respond? Wow. It's okay. I tried actually to evade saying anything about that, but for now we see that it was mostly China who was benefiting from this strategic landscape in this strategic triangle. And I guess that it is in Russia's and U.S. interest to make at least that China is not here the parties that gains the most benefits. I'm not probably entitled to make some recommendations for the U.S. policymakers, but just looking strategically, I don't think that it is in the U.S. interest to drive Russia closer to China in Asia specifically, because just military, the two countries do have strengths that will make their combined military power much more efficient than one by one. And I should say that Russia has been very careful and mostly did not balance U.S. in Asia for a very long time. This antagonism that we do have in Russia-U.S. relations makes Russia think that everything that U.S. has been doing also in the Indo-Pacific is also directed, well, partly against Russia, which is again driving Russia even more into China's embrace. It could result in these two kind of blocks scenario, which I won't think that would be beneficial both for US and for Russia. Again, I'm not sure that anything is possible unless the relations per se are normalized. According to this logic, it would be better to have some more, well, normal working level dialogue. I don't think that pulling Russia from China or China from Russia is going to be somewhat realistic. To tell the truth, I don't think so. Russia and China are not inclined to take like anti-Russian or anti-Chinese action, like balancing. So I don't think that it's realistic that Russia would join US in balancing China, for example. However, the policy may be somewhat more calibrated so that there could be some response that won't be balancing or anti-China, but that won't be supporting China either, that would be supporting, some kind of polycentric order and with Russia as one of the powers. And here it could be something that would also not contribute to China's strategy, for example. Just again, very calibrated, Russia, I can't imagine a situation where Russia would balance China, and once again, when China would balance Russia with the United States. But we can have a more polycentric, order and more polycentric vision here. Another thing that actually I forgot to say about this technology is now we are witnessing more and more China-US technological competition on new technologies. This is also, I think, a strategic factor that should be taken into account because as Russia now is having problems with getting new technologies from the West, it just has no other option but to turn to other countries for technologies. And if continued, we may have more Russia-China technological cooperation as well, so that Russia would simply have no other option but to have more technological cooperation with China rather than with Europe. I guess that Russia would prefer to have it with Europe, but it seems that now it is not really the option.
So. Okay, here. Not where I pointed to, but okay.
Well, I got it handed it, Jeff. First of all, let me commend CSIS for inviting a Russian speaker and giving us a chance to listen to the other side of the story. Anton Fedyashin, American University History Department here in Washington. Quick question about academics in Russia. Is Russia producing a sufficient amount of Chinese and Far Eastern experts to support what is clearly a burgeoning and very important relationship? And very closely related to that, do you feel that the Russian academic community and think tanks are having an effect on Russian foreign policy formation, or are the two realms compartmentalized? Does the foreign ministry, for example, actively seek the opinion of experts from the academic community? Thank you.
These are very good questions indeed. I guess that we do lack specialists on China. Just real good specialists, and especially we do have training. Our Institute of Moscow City Institute of International Relations, MGIMO, is one of the leading schools, has always been such, international relations and in China. But the current level of relations probably tells us that we need much more specialists here, and I guess that we do have insufficient number, especially in the, you know, like middle generation, middle and probably even young generation. And another issue is that there is now a lot of people talking who are not actual experts on China, on Russia-China relations. And sometimes, I mean, I think it's happening all over the world now because of the interest in China. And sometimes you get quite a distorted picture as if the countries are friends and allies and they are, there is a huge conflict with the US, and they are working together in order to balance US. which is partly maybe true. Of course, there is a lot of antagonism going on, and as I said, this dynamics has been driven. But there are some people who are really presenting quite a distorted images that China is now going to help Russia, economically, for example, which is not the case. We still do have a lot of traditional schools, but their number, I guess, should really be increased here.
Do you have lots of students at MGIMO who are learning Chinese?
I think every year we have got our School of International Relations. I think it is about 10 to 15 students a year. Also other schools which focus on economics, they also have like about 8-10 students a year. All in all, I guess the figure will be about 20 something graduates a year. But probably it's not that sufficient. I can say that the interest to China and Chinese language and studying China has risen everywhere in all Russian universities. And there have been some new language centers and professional training established, but there is difference in quality of this training. And about foreign ministry and opinion of experts. Well, this has been quite an issue in Russia, I guess, for a long time. It's not only on China, it's everywhere. As far as I understand, there are top professionals that do have links with the ministry, but only like top professionals in every sphere. And basically, it is probably through the discourse that the expert community tries to present different visions, different recommendations, the way to go forward, that has some at least impact on thinking. But like some direct established links, we still do lack them.
Okay, could go up here this time.
Thank you. Steve Winters, independent consultant. Some analysts here take the position that they want to focus on what people are doing more than what people are saying. So you mentioned the Vostok exercises, which you've described as the strategic size, which is true. But actually, as I understand it, the number of Chinese military who were participating in that was relatively small as a percentage. However, we had Professor Kashin from Russia here, academician Kashin, who said, no, but the significant thing was not the number of the Chinese who were participating, but the fact that the Russians and the Chinese set up a joint command structure to carry out the exercises, which was unprecedented. And I noticed just on the other side here, with this latest fourth edition of the so-called Armitage Nye report, that the U.S., well, it's the U.S. CSIS, shall we say, suggestions for how the U.S. and Japanese military should work together. They are also pushing very strongly for some types of joint command structures in case these two militaries had to enter into a situation. So it seems to me you do sort of see a block formation taking place here on both sides. What's your analysis?
A lot here, on Russia-China relations specifically and on Vostok, I basically agree with Vasily Kashin, who is Russia's leading expert here. As far as I understand it, is that the fact that China participated and on the level that previously other countries, such as Belarus only, for example, participated in such an exercise was very important. Mongolia was also a party to somehow alleviate these concerns, but it's quite an important figure. However, I don't see that Russia and China established something permanent. There has been no talks about this, and the current level of cooperation seems sufficient for now. The thing is that if both countries perceive U.S. threat as being on the increase, there may be a desire to have, I don't know, exercise in other domains that the countries haven't tapped into yet, such as submarine, for example, or to move to some closer and permanent actions. As for U.S. Japan, I mean, it's quite different still. So we still do not have this formal political decision to make it an alliance, if this decision emerges or not, I think, is dependent on the U.S. policy, actually, and how Russia and China perceive the U.S. policy.
Okay, let's go here.
Добро пожаловать. Я Марина Фазыл, афганка-американка и журналистка. Marina Fazal, African-American journalist. Welcome to Washington, D.C. If you would please comment about the Belt and Road project, how the initiatives and ambitions of China and Russia converge or diverge specifically in terms of Afghanistan, and also about the initiatives in the Arctic. I'm also a Canadian permanent resident, so it interests me in what ways the international waters and Russia's ambition to create a multipolar world and the way that it has stated its ambitions in those terms, not specifically to oppose the United States, but to make sure there's balance and that it's a multipolar world. Can you comment about the Arctic waters and in what ways a Chinese and Russian alliance there and further explorations would ensure a multipolar world? Thank you.
I'm not an expert on Afghanistan, unfortunately. So in terms of questions remaining and time, I would probably, avoid this question. Of course, China has really stepped up its economic presence and even security presence, and there is there is new four-party dialogue with Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Tajikistan. So China strives to play a larger security role here. This is what I can say for sure. Russia would also like to see Afghanistan stabilized. However, I'm not working on Afghanistan, I'm not really sure that I know the details. On the Arctic, the Belt and Silk Road became a new extension, the third extension of the Belt and Road Initiative, actually, and China published its Arctic strategy last year, January. So we do have here as well both points where the interests of both countries do converge and do diverge. So on the convergence issue, Russia is interested in its own northern sea route and having this sea route as an alternative route to the Malacca Strait and to the Suez Channel, so this southern sea route, and is interested in it developing as an international water shipping lane. And one of the countries that has been using it, apart from Russia, has been China, actually. So Russia sees this as an opportunity for China to invest into its northern territories also, because this northern sea route still lacks infrastructure, a lot of infrastructure. And there are a number of countries that have been using it, but not that much, and China has been the most of these foreign countries that has been using it here. Again, I do not work on the Arctic specifically, but as far as I know, Russia has been considering this waterway as its internal waterway, and there are different positions on the Arctic between the five Arctic states, Russia's position is somewhat similar to Canada, more as far as I know, than to other parties, including the U.S. Russia understands that, believes that this waterway is under its sovereignty, and this again deals with different positions, legal positions on the Arctic. As for China, it has produced this notion of the near Arctic state in its new Arctic strategy, which is kind of a new notion. And China has been arguing for the freedom of navigation here in the Arctic, which is kind of a different interpretation of what it thinks should be in the Pacific and other seas. China here, in legal terms, China's position here on the Arctic is even closer to that of the United States than to Russia, as it thinks that this should be open waters for everyone. Russia insists that our Russian icebreakers, for example, are used and other logistic means, in accordance with its legal position of the Arctic. So here we can see again both points of divergence, especially on the economic front, and some points of convergence on the legal issues and how these countries perceive the Arctic. However, as far as I understand Russian foreign policy thinking, the greatest concern has been NATO, recent NATO actions concerning the Arctic rather than China, actually, which has been cooperating with Russia here still.
Okay, Harley.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm Harley Balzer from Georgetown University.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. Just a balance problem. I wanted to ask you about the top-down versus bottom-up. And if this relationship is going to be stable, there's got to be something other than the Putin-Xi connection. They do meet more often than Putin meets anybody else.
Yeah.
But investment has been a problem, as you mentioned. In Pakistan, if you take the official numbers, it's 10 times more. It might only be 4 or 5 times more. Mm-hmm. Remember in 2011, the governor of Irkutsk blew up a meeting by screaming that China invested more in Africa than in Russia. Most of the economic stuff has been top-down. The standard enterprises, and in China, the average standard enterprise, if you count all the subsidies and low interest loans, loses about 6-7% a year.
So in
China.
In Russia, right?
In China.
Okay.
What China's been doing in Xinjiang has been resonating with the Muslims in a lot of places. Nazarbayev's keeping a lid on it in Kazakhstan, but he's having trouble. Dagestan, it's the local press a lot more. The ecology issues in the Far East have been getting a lot of play in the local press. Sociologists in Chita and Blagoveshchensk have been writing about Chinese exporting their polluting factories to Russia with Chinese management. And if you take the latest Nikolskaya Dmitriev focus group data, Russians' values are much closer to European values than Chinese values. So, you know, is this going to work without some bottom-up addition to the top-down efforts?
Thank you for the question. It is a very, these are all very important issues that you have raised. I was also thinking of incorporating a number of them, but then kind of reduced in order to touch upon different spheres. But yes, basically this has been one of the major problems in Russia-China relations, is that our economic cooperation and people-to-people has been lagging behind the political, the official level. This has always been the case, and it's not only just the number of trade and investment. It is probably even more the spheres and the operation, the way of operation, the mode of operation that has also been a problem, as you said. I mean, China has been behaving in a similar way in different countries, including Russia. So it's not something, I guess, specific only for Russia-China relations. There have been a number of problems with the timber industry and illegal harvesting of timber. There have been a number of ecological problems, such as even in agriculture, for example, when Chinese farmers come and then the soil cannot, after they use it, it cannot be really used for many years. There is a number of such problems also with rivers, and sometimes chemical waste from China go to Amur River and other rivers. So there has been also an issue. Generally, cross-regional cooperation has been not really well developed between Russia and China, which is also partly, according to our Far Eastern experts, due to the fact that these both regions are kind of backward regions for both countries. So it's Far East, the backwards of of Russia in terms of development, of economic development, and the same for China bordering regions. And there has no been real comprehensive plan how to upgrade them. And we have recently seen some new forms of cooperation cross-regional going on. And now we are finishing building the bridges across the Amur River. The projects that have been in place, for those who have been following it, for a couple of decades already. So probably we will finish them this year. Two bridges, railway and automobile bridge, which were long overdue, but we still do have problems with crossing the borders, with cross-border infrastructure, which is really in bad shape. So there have been all these issues, and one of the key understanding is that unless we make it sufficient, more economically sufficient, more viable, and in forms that would not cause the anti-China reaction in Russia, which is sometimes also the fact. We won't have these relations that much stable and that much beneficial to each other as we would like them to be. And the economic sphere, of course, is the one which has been lagging behind the economic and political cooperation. And as I tried to show, there have been new projects, but the new quality has not really emerged yet. And partly, this is also Russia that should do better its homework on how to make this more efficient, how to make the investment climate more efficient, and how to implement all the laws and really to watch over what is being done on the Russian soil, and of course to tackle corruption here. So as far as I know, that the Chinese businessmen also have somewhat changed in the last years, and also in terms of cross-regional cooperation, there have been some new interest for those people who have not really exited Russia, because a lot of Chinese actually went back to China after 2014, when Russia's ruble got depreciated, and it was not economically interesting for them to stay in the forest longer. So those who have stayed, many of them see some new spheres, such as agriculture, for example, which is, and food security. Agriculture from Russia to China, which is one of the spheres where more sustainable cooperation can take place. Again, if the two countries somewhat find these issues, it's one of the things that I guess Russia and China need to work better on, and especially the Russian side.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes left. I was going to say, I think let's take a couple of questions and then I'll sort of let you answer them as you choose. So let's start over here.
Thank you. Austin Doler, Center for European Policy Analysis. Now, I think in terms of possible conflict versus cooperation points for Russia and China, to what extent is Central and Eastern Europe and the Balkans such a point, with BRI being, China being involved through BRI in the 17+1 format? Could we see conflict where Russia perceives this as China intervening in a region that's historically been in its, quote, sphere of influence? Or could we see some cooperation, whereas China and Russia, whether explicitly or implicitly, agree to let China economically invest and leave China to have this kind of cultural or ethno-national kind of influence, especially in a place like the Western Balkans with Serbia and Macedonia? Thank you.
Okay, so Southeastern Europe, Western Balkans, Steve. Oh, sorry, Steve, and then I'll get you next.
Yeah, Stephen Blank, American Foreign Policy Council. Anna, about 8-9 years ago, when the New START treaty was signed, Sergei Lavrov and other officials said that the next treaty would only be negotiated if China was in the room. Now we are beginning to talk again about a new arms control treaty. The Chinese have indicated they will not participate, and yet what we hear from Russia is total silence. What has changed and why?
Okay, and then the lady in front of you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you for your remarkable, open, and informed session. Oh, sorry. So my name is Anita Parlow. I was with the Harvard-MIT Arctic Fisheries Project and Fulbright in Iceland, and I just came back from China on the Polar Belt and Road initiative, of which there are about 600, 800 people there. And like Iceland, likes to sort of bridge dimensions, I do believe there's room for three great powers on the planet. So having said that, so my question is, you mentioned you started with the issue of norms, the question of norms and standards and how that might evolve. And if we can talk about it in the Arctic context, so there's an enormous amount, as you pointed out, trade going on and will go on further in terms of natural resources development, port and infrastructure development, mainly being financed by China and very much welcomed by Russia, as I understand it. And China has two icebreakers, ice-capable container ships, and Russia has its rules of the road becoming more Russian flag and navigability questions. And then the issue of that has been brought up of international versus internal waters.
Can we get the question?
So is China going to ultimately agree with the United States in terms of the characterization, the legal characterization of the waters over across Canada and Russia? And at what point do you see Russia and China's interests is converging in the context of what nominative standards would apply? Thank you very much.
Okay, so we've got a lot here. So Southeastern Europe, arms control, and then norms in the Arctic.
Mm-hmm. As far as Southeastern Europe, I mean, 16 plus one and Central Europe and Balkans are concerned, I guess that we need to have a look also at what is the level of the level and the nature of the current characteristic of ties of Russia with these countries, and whether Russia has a big or not really big economic presence, and what are the political relations here. So I guess it will be different in some countries in Central Europe that do not have that much links with Russia, and with many of them, and the Baltic states really do not, having very antagonistic policy towards Russia. So I guess this is one of the things that we could take into consideration here. Basically, Russia makes note of what China has been doing with 16 plus one and these states. It is that Russia's resources to somehow step up its own economic presence are kind of limited. I guess Serbia will be one of the countries where Russia's presence has been growing and where economic operation has been developing here. Basically Russia does not, officially you will never see any criticism of whatever China does with the states. As far as I understand, Russia, understands what China is doing, but there are kind of no real now new resources to put up here in this region. And with a country such as Serbia, where it really does have good connections, including in economics, it is trying, Russia is trying to do what it can. So I guess this should be the part of the picture. Russia is much more interested in how to save Russia-EU economic relations and its economic partnerships that it has actually built with many countries in the European Union, I guess. About START and new arms control treaty and why there is silence. As far as I understand, Russia has raised this topic in its negotiations with China. However, we have not really seen the positive answer of the Chinese side. And Lavrov also said that there should be talks on China with this issue, and we should talk to Chinese partners. But at the current point of time, the crisis going on in Russia-US relations and Russia's foreign policy being rather antagonistic towards US, and US foreign policy also being antagonistic towards Russia, I don't really see that Russia would somehow criticize China in not joining the New START treaty. Although Russia, of course, would like to have this new arms control and regime, basically, as far as I understand, our military experts also to be part of this multilateral format. So I guess this is the picture that we do have now. Russia would love to, Russia thinks that it would be better for everyone if we negotiate and save the arms control. But if the U.S. does not want it at this stage, there is nothing we can really do by ourselves here. So I guess this is the reaction that we do have now, basically. And the last thing about the Arctic. Norms and standards in the Arctic, this is a very interesting question because China's interest in the Arctic has really grown, and China would like to step up its presence. And even if you see, just look at the maps of the Polar Silk Road and the Northern Sea Route, you will see that this is basically one and the same shipping lane. So it puts China on the way that it needs to have cooperation with Russia if it wants to also if it wants to have it somewhat developed or not derailed at least. I mean, the same as with the Belt and Road in Eurasia, China also needs well at least Russia somewhat cooperation, at least not antagonism, if it wants to succeed with the Eurasian part of the Belt and Road. And is there any agreement about the rules and the norms? I guess on the legal issues of the Arctic, as we can see from the Russian Arctic strategy and the Chinese polar strategies, as I already said in my answer previously, we do have a divergence actually here in terms of legal interpretations and in terms of China's activity in the Arctic. I'm not again sure that this issue will cause that much of friction now, again amid the deteriorated Russia-US relations and NATO activity in the Arctic and recent things. But it's not the issue that the two countries actually see eye to eye to each other. And I guess one of the things that China's presence has grown, China's interests have grown, and China's interests in the Arctic have been one of the new kind of China's interests that, as a kind of a global power that China wants that strives to be as a possible major world leader, thinks that these resources should be the commonly developed resources. I would say that as well as in other regions, we still will see cooperation here between the countries and kind of, divergence and competition below the surface probably as well. However, again, I think that here China needs somewhat cooperation with Russia, and Russia also, as you rightly said, wants Chinese investment in its north. So basically the countries will try not to antagonize this and maybe even maintaining somewhat different positions in the Arctic specifically, not really touching upon their differences, but trying to do something on the ground. And as far as I know, China is using Russian icebreakers presently. So, it could be an issue if China chooses that it wants to use its own icebreakers. That's it.
Okay. We are at our ending time, so we have to leave the room. But I want to thank you all for coming. And please, let's thank Anna.